Trigger on!
Welcome, dear all, to the Duckface Diaries. We are a World Trigger read-through podcast aiming to discuss the World Trigger manga volume by volume. I'm Wazel Cheddar.
And I'm Hoven with an H. In this episode, we're digging into volume 21, which covers chapters 179 to 187, and is adapted across episode 8 to the start of episode 12 of season 3 of the anime.
Once again, not a very clear-cut thing. But anyway, here we are. We're digging into it. We're digging into it so much. How have you been doing, Hoven?
Dig a tunnel, dig a tunnel, dig a tunnel, pick before the enemy Largon comes. Okay, anyway.
Row, row, take a shower.
I'm doing all right. It's been a pretty full week of work, but I think I'm not doing too badly, all things considered. How have you been?
I've been all right. I've taken a holiday. Why am I speaking in American terms? I've taken a bit of a holiday to go to my grandparents' place, and it just hit me after 20-something years, I will not reveal my age, that my whole family is addicted to coffee. It turns out that, so my mum, I knew that she drinks like 3 or 4 coffees a day. I limit myself to just one, but then again, I started very much late. My granddad also does 1 or 2, but my gran, it's inexplicable. Like, she drinks coffee before she falls asleep. What is going on there?
Yeah, I mean, coffee after a meal is, like, often a thing, but that tends to be for, like, a restaurant or something. I definitely had a bit of a too-many-coffees problem for the first year of my job. I've now managed to curb it by buying decaf bags where I can, so when I have my morning coffee, I always have a decaf, and then any additional ones, it means that I only have, like, 1 caffeinated a day, usually.
Oh, shit, we just prepared you caffeinated when you were in Poland. Sorry about that.
It's okay. It wasn't like a... It's not like a strict dietary thing. It's just a general good habit.
Gotcha.
So I don't care when people give me caffeinated.
I just generally drink coffee when I want to wake myself up, for example, before this recording. And I drink booze whenever I want to get drunk. I'm not really that picky about the flavor side of things when it comes to it, so I drink both for a purpose.
Do you have a preference between black and milky?
Oh, I definitely drink black. For some reason, I can drink milk whenever, but when it's like a combination with coffee, it makes me a bit sick. I don't know why. I can have the two things like separately, but not at once.
It's like my thing with mashed potatoes. I can't eat it without getting a headache, even though I like all other forms of potatoes.
Apart from that, so today, while preparing for this podcast and while like taking some notes ahead, I've come across a nature documentary narrated entirely by Barack Obama. It was quite a strange experience to like listen to him.
I mean, I imagine his voice would fit it quite well for a nature documentary.
Yeah, but then there was a bit like there were 2 llamas like chasing each other, and I think one bit another in the balls, and like he was like, and this male is not afraid to do a low blow or something, and I didn't expect this former president of the United States to do that specifically.
He's literally playing a game of Obama Llama.
But anyway, we should probably talk about volume 21. So, as usual, story and art is created by Daisuke Ashihara, translated by Caleb Cook, touch-up and lettering done by Acecore Chrisman, design was handled by Julian J.R. Robinson, it was edited by Ray First. Get well soon, Ray. We're going to do a bit of a summary of volume 21. After that, we are going to move on to our general thoughts. Do you have any spoilery notes?
Not really. I had one that could have been, but yeah, I've moved it to the Q&A section.
Q&A is going to be a bit spoilerific since we're talking about first part of a climactic fight, obviously. Then there's going to be the Q&A section. And yeah, ready to go with the summary?
Let's do it.
Though, just before we move on, I'd just like to mention that this episode was made possible by my generous supporters on Patreon, who get access to bonus rewards such as our bonus pods on Ashihara's previous works. I am sadly currently looking for work, so if you enjoy the show and would like to support it, consider visiting patreon.com/wesleydalecheddar. I recently taken the time to add some new goals, such as a special podcast on the anime filler arc, which to this day Hoven hasn't yet watched, so I think we'll have a lovely time with that. We've been doing this for a while now and are always having a blast, and every single donation can help keep the release as consistent as possible, no matter how small. But enough about that, on to the recap. I hope you enjoy it. Previously on World Trigger, Hughes decided to confront Chica about the matter for the last time. Can she shoot people or not? After all, the team's strategy rides on whether that is the case, as she could earn a lot of points by herself with Meteor alone. Chica says that she can't help to imagine someone getting hurt because of her. Like Hatahara, she imagines flesh and blood bodies here, but Hughes counters, well, if she doesn't shoot, Osama and Yuma would die on a real battlefield. Then Chica has a panic attack, as she suggests she would probably shoot if her friends were in danger. He leaves the sniper with these thoughts, expecting an answer soon. Composed Beefcake and Osami take Chica to the roof with some tea to calm her down. They try to tell her not to push herself with the answer, but Chica stops them. It seems like she's had enough coddling and she wants to say something she's been holding back for a long time. Chica isn't scared of shooting people. She's afraid of bearing the shame of hurting someone, attracting the fear, the jealousy, the hate that comes with her power. Even with her need to be of use to the team, she wants to seem weak to gather sympathy from others. If Yuma or Osamu's lives were in danger, she knows she could pull the trigger to save the lives, sure, but most of all, so as not to bear the guilt for not saving their lives. In the end, she only thinks about herself, she says. Usami and Reiji reassure her that it's completely normal to be afraid of being blamed, and that none of them would personally blame her for failing to shoot to turn the tide of the battle. Hearing these words, Chica makes a choice. Even with her insecurity revealed, she knows she can trust her comrades completely. It's time for her to fight with all she has. So meanwhile, okay, still not done with the first chapter. Okay, wow. Right. Osama, Yuma, and Konami analyze their opponent in the final match. Yuba Squad describing the captain as more of an attacker who fights with guns than an actual gunner. The Shrimp gets a timely text from his junior shrimp, Midarikawa, saying his squadmate can tell him all about Yuba. So they meet him the next day. Kazuma Satomi, the man with a one-piece mouth, the enthusiastic bespectacled gunner who describes Yuba as the absolute strongest one-on-one, a contender to go against Tajikawa. In fact, the only reason why his squad is so low-ranked is because they had tragically lost a vital member to college. Damn it, rugby!
Karasawa intensifies.
As Yuma heads to meet Yuba, Osama stays behind to ask Satomi for his opinion on Ninomiya, as his self-proclaimed zealot. He describes him as the absolute strongest one-on-one. Osama is confused, to say the least. So Satomi explains that he himself fights as a gunner, imitating Yuba's techniques along with Ninomiya's shield killer strategy, utilizing a combination of small and big bullets to circumvent both a spread out or a concentrated defense. When posed with the question many a weeb has a strong opinion about, who would win, Satomi says Ninomiya would win most of the time, but if they face each other up close, Yuba could take him out due to the fast reaction time that a gunner trigger allows. Before we cut to Yuba's strategy room, Jin approaches Osama and drops the bombshell that the consultant has been the number one gunner all along. So Yuma meets Yuba, the absolute drill sergeant, who greets him with a hearty, "Well met!" Alongside comes Abishima, Yuma's nervous fangirl, who her captain encourages to express her appreciation of the shrimp by making an Armin Attack on Titan speech. So Yuma returns the gratitude by misgendering her, for which he has to pay by giving her a training session. He seems to be going easy on her, which Yuba rightfully considers disrespect, finally respecting Obishima's wish for an honest fight, Yuma demonstrates a new technique. He throws a scorpion shuriken on the ground next to her, then releasing an underground mantis with his foot, connecting with the projectile and stabbing the Kogetsu-wielding private from behind. Grateful for the lesson, Yuma gives Kuga a match of his own, instantly blowing him to bits. Given it's the final match, he will make sure his squad will give it all they've got to maintain their rank. Midorikawa finally gets his rank battle with Jin, as he cashes in a favor with Yuma, and the shrimp has no choice but to request it from the talented elite on his behalf. Back in Tamakoma base, Mikomo's squad analyze what they've learned about Yuba, and how him focusing on powerful close-range shots, he takes a very different approach to combat than most gunners. After thinking up some countermeasures using walls and wires, they move on to discussing Ninomiya. They bet that the number one shooter will try to corner them one-on-one. Hughes says he would have a problem with that, as the try-on gap would leave him at a loss in both full shield and full attack mode. Then Chika makes an announcement. In the next match, she's going to use normal bullets, as she was able to understand something inside herself. Osama is apprehensive, but when he sees Yuma supporting Chika's decision, even with his lie detector side effect, he decides to give it a go, as long as he is the one to give the order to shoot. Still eager to figure out a plan B, Osama asks Scruffy Hottie for help, asking him to come to the training room.
Osamu's request for Scruffy Hottie is for him to emulate Ninomiya's fighting style with help from the training room's programming to emulate his Treon. After groveling to Konami to take his dinner shift, he agrees. After overwhelming the team several times, Scruffy Hottie unearths Osamu's real plan. Rather than beat Ninomiya one-on-one, he wishes to draw out Nino's full offense and thus create an opening in his defenses. Osamu observes from their takoyaki restaurant conversation that Ninomiya himself is a much more emotion-driven combatant than his teammates, and thinks he could use this to Tamakoma's advantage. The squad enjoy a curry rice dinner before the night of the big match. A panel of Takatomi, Konami, Oji, and Kurauchi introduce the match as commentators, nudging the fourth wall to inform readers that the daytime match ended with Azuma squad narrowly beating Kagura and Oji squad. Moving on to the match at hand, Konami is confident that Tamatu can grab the 4 points they need to ascend to the second rank, but Oji has his doubts. Ninomiya's survival track record and refined knowledge of Hughes' powers by everyone all give Tamakoma a lot more to work against than the previous match. Upon Yuba squad picking up their usual map of Cityscape B, the commentators touch on the team's strong desire to preserve their rank. Over in the strategy room, Tamakoma discussed their ideal scenario would be Hughes and Chika meeting to team up, following which they'd repeat their wire zone strategy from prior matches. If this ends up being unfeasible, their backup will be for Yuma and Hughes to become the primary attackers instead. Over in Yuba squad, the captain instructs sniper Kazuto Tanuka to target Chika, wary of her destructive capabilities, and prompts Obishima herself remain wary of Yuma's constantly changing tactics. Squad operator Nono Fujimaru imitates a former squad mate Kanda to motivate them, and they resolve to enjoy a victory dinner after the match. Ikoma squad exchange completely irrelevant stories and banter as Oki sits in silence while Maori and Mizukami continue to share the team's collective brain cells. Unsatisfied with the earlier nudging of it, Ikoma smashes through the fourth wall with gusto. Ninomiya squad are practicing training routines up until the 11th hour as Hyami instructs them that the match is about to begin. The squads warp in with Tamakoma at a great disadvantage.
With a bin full of gin.
Jin is asked to leave the match, especially considering that he took an unnecessary rubbish receptacle into it. Hughes is surrounded by enemy squads to the northeast, far from his teammates. Ninomiya fires on Osamu and Chika down to the southwest shortly after they meet, with assistance from Tsuji. Chika briefly wavers in firing back with Yuma, but after some gentle encouragement from the duck-faced lad, lets off a hound to get him off their case. This does, however, alert Tanuka to their location. Back up in the north, squads close in on each other, prompting an ongoing dialogue between Kai and Ikoma about which agents are popular. Hughes tries to make a beeline for his teammates by equipping Bagmon, but this only paints more of a target on his back as every nearby squad notices this and closes in on him, resulting in a chaotic brawl. Hughes takes significant damage as enemy squads scramble to take him out. Kai attempts and fails to take out Yuma in the midst of this chaos, Mizukami advises that he sticks to the pincer attack. Osamu instructs Yuma and Chika to take up a sniping position to back up Hughes, but as this unfolds, Hughes insists that she targets the area with a meteor instead, sacrificing him for the points that they need. Just as she attempts this, Tanuka, who had been carefully tracking her this whole time, scores an impressive shot on the very tip of her meteor, blowing it and the building they're standing on top of to smithereens. Chika and Yuma survive with the sniper's impenetrable shield, but Tamakoma's situation is looking dire.
Oh, you meant Tanooka. Right. I kept thinking, who the fuck is Tanooka?
Oh, yeah, no, that makes a lot more sense, yeah.
Sorry about that.
Tanooka, I mean, really, Tanooka should use a bazooka.
I was, like, imagining a Tanuki in Yuba Squad uniform.
No, it's a Tanuki that ate the bazooka fruit.
General thoughts.
Let's do it.
So this volume is great. World Trigger is a series with so much apparent focus on tactics and calculation, but parts like this reminded me how there is so much emotion behind it, and I think like this emotion is the central theme of this volume. This arc is a great example of it. That's, hey, look, Ashihara even managed to draw a crying person and make it look good, unlike his previous attempts. But yeah, and like in all seriousness, like Chika's scene is just mwah, best speech in World Trigger by far, according to me. no one important. Yeah, but when it like hits her and she realizes her internal turmoil that up till now she had only been feeling subconsciously, it's like Ashihara, I kind of want to say it's like Ashihara drew her having therapy without actually having therapy, which I realize is a bold statement, but in general in fiction, maintenance is not exciting to watch even if it's healthier. There is another moment that focuses on emotion. There's Osamu staking his plan on the cold, calculating Ninomiya, apparently, acting rashly and rushing into single combat.
One thing I did really like about Hughes confronting Chika is that he doesn't come off actively malicious. He's very indelicate and clearly a bit impatient with her problems, but he is genuinely confused by them. He has this internal logic of a lifelong soldier, and this kind of naturally manifests itself in an indelicate and harsh interrogation of Chika's states. She's not really someone that he can relate to. And yeah, I really like Satomi's introduction. That time-honored shonen tradition of introduce a daft goofball and then later reveal that said goofball is one of the strongest characters. I am a sucker for it every time. See also, like, you know, like Urahara and Isshin from Bleach or Blackbeard from One Piece.
Definitely. He has a very similar design to Yuba, is what I thought at first, but which is why I like mixed them up earlier on in the recap. I think Satomi is great. I think Yuba's a great character. I didn't pay enough attention to him on my first read-through because I was too focused on Ninomiya and Ikoma as opponents. But his whole vibe is so charismatic. His framing is, I don't know how to say it, like high concept. When I see him like a close-range gunman style with a bagworm cape, I can't help but think that this is like a sheriff from a spaghetti western.
He's this weird mishmash of a drill sergeant and a cowboy without fully being either one of them.
Like the spaghetti western vibe fits even more given like his white uniform. That's how like the good guy is dressed.
Mm.
The battle system concept is like great too. He's a powerhouse based on such a simple idea as what if guns but close? Even the manga itself notes that there is a neat progression of techniques between Suwa, then Yuba being inspired by Suwa, then it was Satomi being inspired by Yuba, then Ikoma wanting to counter Yuba with the whole attacker-killer moniker.
Yeah, I think Satomi he's the absolute strongest one-on-one, is his rendition of it's the perfect time to start reading along. One thing the anime did was the translations for this praise of Yuba is a bit different. It says he's invincible in one-on-ones, which I don't like as much. I think it undercuts the joke that this would confuse Osamu.
Because that you can say that for more than one person and have it not be weird.
Mm-hmm. I think Caleb did a greater job on that to, like, carry the humour through in that chapter.
Yeah. How dare you, underpaid Crunchyroll translator! Yeah, and I think, as you said, just the whole scene with Chica at the beginning is such an emotional peak for the series. It's, like, moments like that and the climax to the large-scale invasion arc that are just so special, and the series operating at its absolute peak. And one thing I really like is that how Reiji's comment on Osamu and Yuma won't judge you for underperforming is something that she needs to see put into practice to fully shed her nerves. Like, we see when she is hesitant about firing on Ninomiya and Tsuji, Yuma's side effect picks this up and prompts him to assure Chika in a really easygoing way to just give firing at them a go. And I think it's that kind of, the way he phrases it is like, you can give it a try. It really kind of validates what Reiji said earlier and is very assuring for Chika.
I like Yuma using his side effect to determine Chika's line that she can shoot at Ninomiya. It was like a nice detail, and it was interesting that he omits this part when relaying this info to Osamu so she doesn't feel bad.
Yeah.
Yuba being a solo rank war enthusiast and earning his rank through duels is a really cool way to build him up, but also a cool way to like see the ranking system, that it's more complicated than just whoever has most points is the strongest. Also, I can't look at Yuba's expressions without immediately thinking of The Way of the House Husband. did you notice that as well?
I could definitely see that. Also, we compared Satomi to a lot of people, but I always see him as kind of the other side of the coin of just Mace Hughes, but World Trigger. But
so many Mace Hugheses. Oh my god. So speaking of Hughes, this Hughes, as in Husei, claiming it's impossible for him to use two different shields when we've seen Izumi use like a dozen against High Rain. I guess maybe he means like two of different density, or maybe like what Izumi was using was like one shield that was scattered into several.
Yeah, I think he means shields of different density, because that is something that's specified to be Ninomiya's big trump card, that you can switch between those two types of bullets to target separate shield types of different entities. Yeah, like, it will eventually get through it. That's the thing. It's like, you know, he can, I think that's the way the shields work. Sustained fire can whittle them down to different rates, but they will whittle them down eventually.
Osamu insisting on calling Chika's real shots could so easily, like, read as him trying to, like, reassert control of the situation when, like, he loses authority or something, kind of the way that another character does in the away mission test. Kiri does kind of consider chaos on the battlefield and how Chika could easily panic during this kind of breakthrough. Also, like, during the dinner scene, we got one non-sweaty Osamu. he's come so far in not sweating. I'm so proud of him.
Ikoma, as always, is very funny throughout this volume. The way the anime holds on Ikoma dramatically sitting down at the start of his squad meeting before chatting complete bollocks is just wonderful. And also just the way he's animated in all of the flashbacks to talking about Hughes. Sorry, not talking about Hughes, talking about Jin, and just in, sneaking in on his match.
Ikoma squad never fails to be completely distracted, and I do sometimes wonder if Ikoma himself, if his side effect is to see the fourth wall. It must be, right?
Perhaps. Other things in the anime, the one other note I have for it is that Chika's scene, big scene, the volume, is handled very well. Obviously, we touched on how much Ashihara's art depicting this had improved. There's like small panels of her panicking are given much more gravitas and weight and time to breathe, like each little kind of sigh, each time that she's preparing to say something. The expressions are even more clear, and I think the anime only enhances what Ashihara has done here. There's one anime original shot. Chika's hair partially obscures her face from the side, which I thought was a really nice, like, embellishment to the scene.
I did like what the art here did as well with the speech bubbles. How, like, the borders become... Ah, borders. How the borders become kind of, like, wavy, I suppose. I've got to note, Scruffy Hottie in Ninomiya's getup. damn. This makes me kind of wonder why they didn't have these, like, Tamakoma 1 simulations before. I guess it would have made the pacing even more bloated, but it seems like a fun idea to like, practice on your seniors to emulate the big battle.
I think, to comment on that, my damn moments of this particular spread was in the anime when the Inamiya squad are, like, training, and it's just, especially when Inukai and Tsuji are getting ready to go. They just look really cool. The way they kind of, Inukai brushes back his hair and stuff. And then also, I never realised how much that Nonon Fujimaru was pretty my type. Yeah,
she's very nice. Speaking of operators, I usually like to see a variety of operators doing the play-by-play, but it's nice seeing Sakurako return for the final one. Really nice way to tie everything together. I do love Konami on during this fucking match. She never stops revealing Osama's secrets and does so even more during the next volume. It's quite amusing. I know it doesn't matter in a play-by-play, but still, come on. There's a lot of shifting in the squads, which kind of foreshadows like the purpose of the one of the purposes of the away mission test. Like Oji and Kurouchi used to be in the Yuba squad. I wonder how that dynamic even worked. Who would Yuba even be in Code Geass?
Yeah, I guess it's more that the shuffling that occurs is just on a scale that they're not used to, and obviously they've had less time to adjust to all of the new team.
The squads regularly shuffle around. Some of the people here may become captains and form their own squads, like Asuma did several times, and so some people might be captain material. You can see here that like it happened basically with OG. There's a standout comedic panel, actually several. I do love the panels where Ikoma just listens to Mizukami's reports during the match, and he says, like, yeah, Kai is popular, roger, roger. It's like played completely straight, as if this is vital combat info, and he actually repeats this. I love this.
One nice thing is I like kind of the ticking clock that kind of diffuses and builds tension with Tonooka, I'm going to say his name right now.
Hey.
Sort of keeping tabs on Chika and Yuma, and the little detail of they went behind the water cooler. Maybe she's safe now. Ultimately, the trick shot gets them.
Yeah, that was quite clever. I legit forgot Tonooka was such a big deal. Like, it seems like all of Yuba squad are solo fighting specialists. Which is something that the match like heavily focuses on.
He debatably affects the battle the most in his entire squad.
It's a nice payoff to the previous musings about sniping at Meteor, which happened, I think, during the last Azuma match. Hughes's plan failing is also a treat, but because like his experience doesn't mean insight in everything.
Things are always subject to change on a battlefield, especially one with just so many participants.
And yeah, so speaking of the many participants, it goes without saying that the battle is very tense for Hughes as he's attacked from all sides. And the last time I've seen a World Trigger battle be this tense, I think it was like during the invasion chase.
Yeah, it also brought to mind, I think, when there was a very chaotic brawl in the middle of, I think it was Kageura's first match, when there was just kind of a big melee of people from all different squads clashing in the middle, and it.
Yeah, just a bundle of attackers, yeah. My last note is something that Osama says, is that like he set up dummies and wire traps for like their opponents not to chase after them after like he meets up with both Chika and Yuma. Did he like equip dummy beacons? It doesn't seem to be focused on that much, and dummy beacons take up a lot of try-in from what we've heard, so I guess maybe a weird translation choice, but because like the word dummy carries a lot of meaning in World Trigger.
Okay, shall we go to the Q&A section?
Yeah, let's do it.
Goda has a big body on the Reddit, says...
This is such a very Hoven bait name.
Sorry, Gaudy has a big body. There we go. Good day, Wensley and Hoven. One of my favourite aspects of Rank Wars, especially the second half, was Daisuke allowing us time to breathe instead of giving us constant action like most other shonen, causing the reader to eventually get overwhelmed and lose interest. The build-up to the final match was sublime, including the numerous setups, such as setting up Yuma versus Yuba's rematch,
due to his swift defeats, and the bait of making you believe that you'll see Hughes and Nino battle, or that you would see a possible Hughes and Chica combination using their tremendous trionic advantage over the enemies. What do you think of how Ashihara-sensei set those ideas ultimately to subvert them? Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, yeah, you've basically hit the nail on the head there. Like, I've heard some of my peers say that, like, the intricate pre-planning and commentary scenes in World Trigger are kind of redundant, as in the end we see everything played out in the battle itself. But, well, the thing is, not everything has to play out the same way. Sometimes the predictions are accurate, and sometimes it's completely subverted, as you've said. And the precedent for the pre-planning itself allows for this subversion. It makes for a very interesting setup, and it pays off quite well in this match, as it's very tense as to when is Hughes going to use his Viper strategy. It obscures something else that happens in like the resolution of the match.
Yeah, I think he sets up those expectations not simply to build up the fight, but to outline Tamakoma's ideal scenarios, only to pull the rug out from under them and force them to achieve their desired outcomes, which, as you said, are veiled throughout the match and only hinted at, and do so from a much more challenging position than they had earlier.
This being like the second Ninomiya battle is also very, and the second Ikoma battle makes the setup here be kind of obscuring setup that happened previously. You remember like the first rank battle between Hughes and Ikoma, him having a big moment with Ikoma during the rank war here. It also very much pays off in a very satisfying way. Not to mention Osamu, Chika, and Ninomiya, like the, I guess, trichotomy between them is very much focused on early on. Then we introduce Hughes to kind of take some attention away from it, to make things a little less obvious, which is why when it pays off, it works so much better.
One really standout scene from the anime that I glossed over is when Hughes is being closed in on, and he can see Ikoma readying his whirlwind and Yuba about to unload his quick shot at the same time, and everything just slows down and goes to black and white, and that's where the episode ends. It's a really good cliffhanger.
Yeah, I remember that. That was really fun. We might as well do Reddit questions first. So then we have a question from Sexy Smooth Fig. What is with these suggestive names today? What is going on?
I guess our podcast just radiates first.
Now I kind of remembered something. I'm sorry, I have to, before we answer this, I have to do an anecdote. You remember how like, I lost the hard drive and all the data from it, and like, we had a bit of a hiatus because of it? After I got back access to my computer, I created a new folder for, like, the new recordings. It was after episode 18, so absentmindedly, I named it Duckface Diaries Recordings 18+. Which is, I suppose, a choice that I keep reminding myself of.
I hope you guys are ready for the Patreon exclusive Duckface Diaries After Dark spin-off. So,
so the question is as follows. Hey, Hoven Wensley, seeing as this is the last and arguably most important match for Tamakoma second, I'm curious as to your general expectations going into this upon first read-through. Did you think that Chika would be able to pull the trigger, that Hughes would be an instant target, or that even what would come next after the end of such a lengthy but nonetheless memorable arc? Thank you for the podcast. I've had a great time listening to the deep dives. Thank you very much, Sexy Smooth Fig. You are indeed smooth. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for the question. I think on my initial read-through, I suspected that the outcome would be somewhat of a victory, but to what degree I was less certain. I completely did not see Osamu's trick coming, and Chika actually hitting someone felt like, oh, for fuck's sake. One second.
Yeah, I'm fucking leaving this in. This is too good. United States, Canada, Mexico, Panama, Haiti, Jamaica, Peru.
And sorry, to resume my point. And Chika actually hitting someone felt like the most likely outcome, but it also had a lot of tension surrounding it, regardless, due to how long this had been an issue for her, and not to mention her hesitation when first firing on Ninomiya and Shuji like that. As for post-Rank Wars, I was under the impression they'd be going to the away mission much more quickly, with the tests somewhat breezed over. Of course, I'd actually forgotten the tests were a thing, but even upon remembering them, I didn't think they would be an entire additional arc. I knew there'd be plenty of post-Amble and sort of minor developments and conversations between the Rank Wars and the away mission, because there had to be, and that's how World Trigger runs, but yeah, I definitely underestimated it.
Yeah, it's kind of the thing you go into during the previous Q&A, is that a big problem of Ashihara's writing is that he doesn't have like these big moments where he announces that hey, expect this and this. This is going to take a long time, or this is going to take a short time. We don't know what to expect from this. When like the Rank Wars was announced, it was kind of the same problem. And I've said it many times that I'm quite enjoying the current arc, but it was definitely unexpected in this regard. So when it comes to Chika finally being able to pull the trigger, I definitely expected that it was going to happen, but just because it was predictable doesn't mean like that the tension wasn't handled very well throughout this whole match. I thought Ashihara has done a great job at that, as I kept guessing as to when exactly it would happen, which is, I suppose, the important thing. That Hughes would be an instant target, I think it was expected to a certain extent. Like during the early matches, I suppose during the late matches even, when Osamu gained the Y strategy, he definitely became a big target after displaying that for the first time. It was certainly, like, what we were conditioned to think that people would pay attention to Hughes a lot. But also, like, that he would become such a target instantly to so many big players in the match. It was definitely unexpected, and, it's going to be expected because it was the product of random warping at the start of the match.
Okay, and then on Twitter, from friend of the show, Sniper of My Heart, won't lie, that's my answer, I can't do that. For current World Trigger, I think Osamu might control Katori's units until she gets fed up and plays herself. I think the game might be mimicking control units far away, kind of like how you might move a drone.
Yeah, Kendra shares her thoughts on the current chapters in the away mission test and how Katori has kind of lost her motivation as predicted by Wakamura.
Osamu controlling Katori's units is definitely something I thought was coming from the start. Obviously, we had it play out fairly straightforwardly with the assumption that everyone controls their own units at first, but as soon as I have the knowledge that it's a computer game, it's like, okay, you could have other players control it, and Katori's probably not going to be very good at this, so, and it would be a fun inversion to, you know, where the characters were at the start of when they first fought, where Osamu was more of an underdog and Katori was more of a falling overdog.
It's kind of a shock how things have changed.
Yeah, this would kind of work until we consider that Katori is a gamer. I think that this is something that it's probable, and I think like the game mimicking controlling units far away, it's how you might move a drone. It's kind of a nice idea of maybe border adapting some of the technology we've seen from Galapola, and maybe this is kind of a test run in that as well. Yeah, I think it's a good interpretation there. I think that's all the questions. So shall we do the round off?
Let's do it.
So, this is going to do it for the 21st episode of Duckface Diaries. You can find us wherever you listen to your podcast. Just search for Duckface Diaries, and we'll be there. Links to all the platforms are at patreon.com/wednesdaydailycheddar. Everything is in the pinned post. That's also what helps me pay the bills, so if you want me to devote more time to making the show better, consider supporting me there. In return, you can get your name in the YouTube credits, or a World Trigger Duckface avatar, or you could get access to some bonus podcasts which are coming up. We've recently recorded a wonderful series of podcasts, so we had a lot of fun with that. It was with friend of the show Maxi Bernard of Friendship Effort Victory and Shonen Flop. They have basically introduced us to Ashihara's previous works, called the big podcast about Superdog Lilienthal, and then we recorded another one going through the one-shots. Trigger Keeper, Talented Elite Jin, fucking that, and also Room 303, the a Tezuka Award runner-up.
Depending on if it's been edited and is up by the time that this episode goes up, definitely, you'll definitely want to check out that One Shots one. You get some prime Wensleydale rant content out of that one. I would not want to miss it.
I'm definitely gonna post like reviews of it on the channel, on the feed, so you'll know when they are up on the Patreon. There will be announcements. And of course, remember that much like The Neighborhood, the YouTube algorithm is a dark abyss of sorrows and woes from which channels like these never resurface, and what helps us navigate it is liking, subscribing, and sharing the podcast with a friend. On the YouTube channel and the same RSS feed, you get access to not only Duckface Diaries, but Manga Mosaic, a collection of podcasts and video essays on other manga titles short along alike. On the same channel and anchor.fm/podcastmonadventures, you can listen to Podcast Mon Adventures, our new retrospective, where we cover the Pokemon special manga, arc by arc, along with the host of the Pink Ale Pod and video essayist Henry Kathman. If you missed it, we've just released an episode last month, so come check it out as we recap the Red, Green, and Blue arc. Hoven, where can people find you?
You can find me on Twitter at Hoven with an H and YouTube, Hoven with an H. Where I have various podcasts, a video essay, and memes.
Lovely. And once again, you can find all the links to that in the description or in the pin post at patreon.com/wensleydalecheddar. Send us emails, questions, comments, suggestions at wensleydale012@gmail.com or follow us on Twitter at Duckface Diaries or individual Twitters at wensleycheddar and at Hoven with an H. Now, a sincere thank you to Milo Jack Silitz for composing music for us, an orchestral rendition of Girigiri, the first opening sequence for World Trigger, and an orchestral rendition of, for the first time, Ashita no Hikari, the second opening sequence for the show in question. You'll be able to hear it in full after the outro. I think we'd like to allow you to listen to it in full because it's a lovely song. You can find his work at soundcloud.com/Milo-Jack-Silitz. Dash.
It's, I made the same mistake trying to Google it earlier today to listen to it. I forgot there were dashes in it as well.
So, what are we covering next time?
Next time, we're covering volume 22, which consists chapters 188 to 196, and is adapted across episodes 12 to 14 of season 3, rounding off the anime!
Woo! Amazing. Once again, we are past the anime. We have been once, and then the anime came back, and now we're past the anime again.
we're just trucking along, and the anime is probably not going to be a thing for another decade, if that. So, yeah.
All right, so now for your patron goers, it's time for some World Trigger After Dark. Welcome, everyone. It's Duckface Diaries Recordings 18+. This was the 21st episode of Duckface Diaries. And as always, it's time to bugger off. Unhinged. Okay.